fighting the Russians, and we can't even get our supplies to them because partisans are blowing up our railroad tracks. So don't you think they should be getting their food first? And then what's left, they'll get yours in time. And the bottom line was, they never got a double ration. They never heard from their husbands and from the brothers and all the people that went to Germany. They were all killed.
Well, now, of course, at what point then did they put all the Jews into one area and build that fence?
That's right. That was the time where they could easily put all the Jews in a ghetto. They put fences around it, usually not just over barbed wire, but brick and mortar and concrete, 10 feet tall. Only one gate in and out to the ghetto. There was 25,000 people in the ghetto, I believe. It was very simple. They put guards and guard towers all around it. They cut off the water, electricity. Wouldn't let in the food allow. So within a year's time, we used up what we had. By that time, people were so sick and so weak that they didn't care what would happen to them. During the winter, it was so cold, 40 below zero. We all burned our furniture just to keep from freezing to death. We all slept with our clothes on. Occasionally, when a woman had a wedding ring, she would throw it across the fence to the Christian, and the Christian would throw back a loaf of bread, and that would last for a little while. We did the same thing with some clothing, a jacket or a coat, throw it over the fence, wrapped around a rock, and then we'd get some food in return. But it didn't go very far. At the end of the year, began evacuating the ghetto.
And of course, they would just come in and then start taking people out in blocks.
They'd come in and they'd seal off three or four streets, would be in the middle of the night, put soldiers all around it. They gave an order, everyone from the houses, to line up in front of the houses. Then they marched in, either on trucks to take them to the train, or just marched them about 10 kilometers to a holding area, staging area, called Kalbasin. And from there, their trains would come, empty trains, take 3,000 people at a time, take them to the Majdanek, Treblinka, or Auschwitz, or any other, or Dachau.
All right, fine. So now, of course, you and your family, though, were there for quite some time before they came for you. Would you like to tell what happened when they actually came for you?
Yes. Well, they began taking 3,000 at a time, and we said there was no hope. And we may as well go because they're going to get us eventually. Nobody gets out alive. So they marched us 10 kilometers to a place called Kalbasin. It was winter. It was cold. On the way, we had beans. We got shoved, we got pushed, we got whipped, and finally we got to Kalbasin. The Kalbasin was divided into many camps. They put so many people in one area, and when the train came, they'd take one section, sort of like cattle stalls, or feed yards, and they'd take out those people, empty that area, put them on the train, send them away. And before they put them on the train, they would supply some bread for the journey, for a five-day journey. It would be a loaf of bread for eight people and some bloodwurst, or it's blood salami. Very little. No water, no sanitation, put them on a train. So there would be wagons. Polish Christians would drive into the camp with the wagons, bring the supplies, put a little bit on the strings. And they needed people to help unload those wagons, so my father volunteered. And when we got done, and the wagons were ready to leave, he jumped in the wagon and nobody saw him and lay down on the floor and was able to escape. Once they got out of the gate, and once the wagon driver got to his home, my father gave him something, I don't know whether it was money or a watch or a ring, to let him take the wagon in next week in his place. So my dad, he agreed, so my dad took the wagon and the horse, and he put his white band around his arm so the people and the SS in the camp would know that he was a Christian and was not one of those that were in the camp. And my dad drove in, but with 5 other wagons with the loads of bread and bloodwurst. As soon as we got there, my dad jumped off the wagon, went to the section, and I was with my family, who was still there. I said to my mother, I'm going to take me and my little 9-year-old brother, and the next transport, I'll come and get you.
Now, of course, your mother was there, and then with your aunts and uncles and the whole
family. Oh, yes, everybody was there from the whole street.
And how many people were there in your family?
Well, I don't know, maybe 20, maybe more.
Right, okay.
I don't remember all the uncles and aunts and cousins. All I remember is my grandmother and my brother and my mother were kind of huddled together. So he said to me, my brother, come quick, let's go. And we began trying to get out of there, get to this wagon. And then this soldier stopped my brother, said, where are you going? And took him away. And it was too small, sent him back to where my mother was. And then came to another gate and he asked me, where are you going? Go back. I said, I don't want to go. This man asked me to come help unload the wagons. He said, go make it quick. So we went and helped unload the wagons. And when it was unloaded, our dad says, jump in the wagon and lay down quietly, which I did. By that time, the 4 wagons already were running towards the gate. It was about a straight run, galloping a straight run of about a 0.5 mile. And my dad whipped the horse and began driving that wagon to catch up with the other 4. In the meantime, the SS commander drove up to the gate and began searching the wagons. My father said to me, you better jump out because they're searching the wagons. So I went to the back of the wagon and nobody could see me. I jumped out and rolled in the snow into the ditch 50 feet inside the gate. And by that time, the commander just drove away, didn't want to wait for the last wagon. And my dad jumped out of the wagon and began talking to the guards before they closed the gate and offered to bring him some soap and other goodies next time he comes around, and maneuvered them with the backwards toward me. And I saw all this, and my dad couldn't wink at me and tell me what to do. I had to think quick. So I got up, and I ran behind the SS's back and jumped into the wagon. My father saw this, and he told the German soldiers, see you later. The father didn't know he was Jewish. And he whipped the horses and took off. So he and I got back to a safe area. But then he returned about a week later to try to get my mother and brother. And by that time, they were gone. So ever since then, it's just been my dad and me. We're the only ones that survived.
And, of course, they took your mother and, and the rest of the family off to a camp.
Right, to Treblinka.
Right. Well, of course, then at that point, of course, here you are, of course, your father and you, and you know, and of course, the Cutfield War, and there's really no safe place for you. So where did you go at that point?
Well, at that time, the ghetto was already empty. There was no Jewish people. Everyone was gone. There was only about maybe 50 or 75 Jewish people left. The Germans gathered everyone, and they put him in a synagogue, old synagogue. And they were going to put him in trucks and take him away somewhere, or to another city. One of the men there said, I have a cellar, a hiding place. It's stocked with bread and water, some sanitation, supplies, and maybe we can wait out there for a few months till the war ended. So my father agreed to go. And me and my uncle, who was an old man, we jumped out of the window, which was one story high at the back of the synagogue, and we began walking to the cellar. It was snowy, so we had to hide our footprints as well. And we had to remove some barricades and some camouflage. And so I thought it was in a bakery, and we just climbed in, lit some candles, and we covered our tracks. All the people that were in the synagogue, of course, taken away. We don't know what happened to them. One of the men had a suitcase. Well, before that, there were some partisans, some young people there. And they said, we're going to go, and we're going to be terrorists. We're going to fight the Germans. And my father wanted to go with them. And they said, we cannot take you because of me. I was only 10 years old. And that it wouldn't be safe because I could cry, I could mess up the whole thing, give them away, it would be risky on the part of a storm. But of course, I didn't go. He didn't want to leave me there.
So, and then, of course, you're living in this cellar, underground, and how long were you there?
Oh, I don't remember, maybe a week, maybe more.
Yeah, of course, there was a gentleman there.
That's right.
A suitcase.
There was one gentleman, there was a former jeweler, and he had a suitcase, a little suitcase, black suitcase, with a goods from his jewelry store, maybe even other jewelry stores, and they took away the jewelers. So there was necklaces and gold rings and pearls.
Right, I'm going to ask you just to hold that for just a moment. We'll be right back here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening is Harold Gordon. We're talking about his book, The Last Sunrise. And incidentally, we carry the book. We think it's a very important book. And it tells the story of the 10-year-old boy who, of course, is there when the war begins. And he lives through all of the terrible, terrible things that happens. And you can sort of see God's hand in preserving him. And time and time and time again, he and his father should have been executed or killed, and yet they survived through the war. So if you'd like to get the book, of course, you give us a call at 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. They can tell you there how to get the book. And you actually have a video which we watched this evening, which is very touching. How can people get in touch with you and get that video?
Well, you could get it through my website. This is Peace, www.peace2.com.
Peace2.com?
Mm-hmm.
All right, fine. That's www.peace2.com. And of course, this is Mr. Gordon just talking about his experiences, and it really doesn't overlap the book at all. The book is certainly one of the most powerful books I've ever read. And of course, those of you who have seen the film The Pianist, when I saw The Pianist, my wife said, you know, I've heard that story before, and she told me about Mr. Gordon's book, which she had read some years ago, because the book is, what, about 10 years old?
That's right.
And, of course, she said, you've got to get Mr. Gordon onto your program. And so we were able to track him down. He lives not too far away from where I do. I live in Santa Cruz or Soquel, which is a suburb of Santa Cruz. And Salinas is probably about 50, 75 miles away from where we live. And so he was gracious enough to agree to come onto our program. And we have a number of interviews with Mr. Gordon, but this is the first time we've had an opportunity to, of course, broadcast in the Great Northwest and the Spokane area there on the American Christian Network. So I wanted to have a chance to hear his story about what actually transpired during that period of time. And so they're, of course, in the cellar, and they decide that the gentleman who is the jeweler, who has a suitcase just packed full of jewelry, and he wants to find somebody who'll put him up for the rest of the war. Why don't you pick up the story there?
Yeah. So this jeweler, his name was Mr. Wise, said to my dad, when my dad was the youngest and strongest and most aggressive, he was only about 35 years old at the time, says, do you know of anybody, any Christian, anywhere that would hide me somewhere till after the war is over? So I'll give him all the gold, all that I have. And this is, I don't know, but let's try. We had several Christian friends. So one night, in the middle of the night, we climbed out of a cellar. There were searchlights ever searching the ghetto in the night, make sure nobody's around, and we had to hide from those. And we had to cross over a cemetery. And at night, of course, with no lights, we couldn't have any lights. And then I had to jump over a 10-foot fence. My dad pushed me up, and I fell over. And in walking, there was open graves. I fell into a grave. And had I screamed, I got, you know, of course, I was scared. You know, could have given everyone away. But I was quiet. My dad reached down and hit me and pulled me out. I walked across the cemetery, down to another fence, down to an embankment to a river, a small river or creek. We crossed that, and we were outside in Polish area. We took off our stuff for David.
Hold that thought for just a moment here. All right. right, fine, this is Dr. Stan, I guess this is Mr. Harold Gordon. And he's describing, of course, one evening they left their area, or the hiding place in the cellar, and of course they are trying to find some place where this Jewish jeweler will be able to spend the war, and he has a suitcase full of valuables, a necklace and gold, and he's quite willing to give this to whoever will be willing to hide him. So why don't you pick the story up there?
So anyway, so we walked a few kilometers to a village, and my father knocked on the lady's door. Well, he came to the door, and the first thing the lady says to us is, "What are you doing there? Please leave. Don't you realize you're endangering your life? If the Germans would catch you, they would shoot all of us." And they would. I mean, if anybody would hide a Jew, the Christians would get shot. They'd be killed. So we walked away. We walked a couple of more blocks to another house. And again, we knocked on the door. And we said, "We have a man here that maybe you can hide. He's got some money. He's got some gold. He's willing to give it to you." She says, "Quickly and quietly, come in." We went into the house, and she put us underneath some steps, a little like a closet underneath the stairs. She says, "Be quiet. I'll talk to you in the morning." And we were. In the morning, we heard soldiers coming down the stairs. They were Gestapo people who lived there. They took over her house, and she would have to cook for them, make meals, clean their clothes. And my heart was beating so hard, I'm surprised he didn't hear it. And as they walked down the stairs treads would bend. The wood was weak. And I could see their boots through the cracks in the steps. So anyway, they had breakfast. They went away, went to work, to their offices, whatever. The Christian lady came, got us out of there, gave us some food, and we told her what we wanted. It was the most dangerous house we could be in. So she said, "I can do it. We have a barn way in the back. I can hide him there amongst the hay. We got some cows there and chickens, and nobody goes there. I'll bring him food every day." And we agreed. So we stayed there the day, and then that night when the Gestapo came, I had the dinner, went to bed. So we crawled out of there, and I took my little suitcase, and my dad took his, and we left that jeweler there. And we walked about 8 to 10 kilometers back to a hiding place inside the ghetto, right across through the river, through the cemetery, over the fence, walked in the dark, bumping into things, finally found a place, got in there. When I got in there, I opened up my little suitcase to change some clothes because I was wet. I saw I had the wrong suitcase. I had his, with all the jewels and all the gold and all the valuables. And I left in my little suitcase, which was nothing, just some old dirty clothes. Well, we said, and Dad says, "I'll just have to go back tomorrow night and take it back." And he says, "You stay here and I'll come back for you." I said, "No, I'm not going to stay here. What if you get caught? What if you get killed? What am I going to do by myself? I'm 10 years old. I cannot do anything." So he agreed to take me with him. So we went back, the same place, knocked lightly on the door at night after the SS Gestapo was asleep. And she let us in, put us under the steps. He was already in the barn, and exchanged suitcases, and we took my suitcase back with us to the hiding place and let the suitcase with the gold go in. When we got back to the hiding place, found out that the previous day our place had been discovered and everything was ransacked. Had we been there, my father and I would have been shot.
And you know, it's amazing because you did do the right thing and took the suitcase back with the gold in it. It really saved your life.
It saved my life.
Right.
It saved my life.
And then, of course, as you read the book through, there's time after time where amazing things like this happen. So then what happens?
So then there was nowhere we could go. We couldn't stay in Grodno, no more Jewish people. We didn't have any money to get anybody to hide us. Besides, we would risk the person's life who were trying to hide us. So we decided to walk 80 kilometers to Bialystok. There was still a Jewish community there. And if we got there, we could just get into the ghetto and be with our own people. So that's what we did. We started walking. It took us 3 days and three nights. We slept in the fields, ate whatever vegetables we could find. Once we got into town there, we were picked up by the SS, and they put us in the ghetto. That's where we wanted to be. So because, and there was no escape. I mean, where can you run? So the borders were guarded, the borders were far away. There was no transportation, no cars, no automobile. So time came, we were in the ghetto in Galveston for about half a month.
I'm going to ask you to hold that thought just for a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan here. Our guest this evening is, of course, Harold Gordon, and he's telling his story of course, his 10-year, now probably 11 and a half-year-old boy, of course, living with his father, the only people in his family who have escaped so far. And, of course, now you put in the Jewish ghetto in the second city. So what happens then?
So then, you know, we just lived there for a while. And then began taking, evacuating that city as well. So the next time a train came along, they wanted to take us, we just went. Actually, we didn't know where they were taking us. We were hoping they would take us to Germany to work, like they said. At that time, nobody knew they were taking anyone to a crematorium or to gas chambers. But we got on the train and packed 100 people into a cattle car, small cattle cars. And we were just standing room only, 5 across. 20 rows, no sanitation, no water. The doors were locked, bolted, and sealed. There was no windows. There were little windows that had barbed wire. Couldn't get out. Locomotive hooked up and began pushing or pulling the train. We kept looking through the cracks in the train walls, wondering where we were going. And we kept going west. So we'd been in the city, and we're going to Western Poland, and we all were thinking, well, maybe we're going to Germany to work, like they said we would. And then horrible things happened on the train. There was no food, it was hot, people were dying. And one time the train stopped for water, to take on water, and an SS soldier was on top of the train and fired a shot into the train, fired his rifle in an angle, and we were all standing or sitting, I don't know what we were doing, but it went through one man's ear, it began to bleed, it barely creased my elbow, and the person behind me, bullet went in the stomach, took him 2 days to die, and luckily I didn't even bleed. Then a few days later, the train stopped, also it was very hot, so my dad lifted me up to get a little air from the window, and a stronger man pushed me away and said, "You've been in the window long enough, and you needed some air." And then a bullet came in through the window, just blew his brain out, and splattered brain all over the place. I didn't even talk about it. On the fifth day, the train stopped. The locomotive unhooked. And he got behind the train and began pushing the train in a forward, in a backward direction. And looking through the cracks, there would be some big buildings and a big gate, and above the gate there was writing in German, says Arbeit macht frei, which means work makes you free. And we're all so glad because we're going to a factory where you work, and we'll be working during the war, and afterwards we'll be free, and everything will be fine. We'll find a mother, a brother, and a family, and we'll all be together again. The train came in to the gate, the locomotive unhooked, the gate closed. A battalion of SS with some machine guns surrounded the train, some soldiers even on the top of the train. A command was given, open all doors were unsealed and opened. Everyone aroused, everyone get out. Everyone was put out in a column in front of the train. The dead people had to be put out, the sick people had to be pulled out. The ones that were bleeding had bandages on them. They had to be pulled out, everyone had to be counted. And right in front of it, there were some Jewish people from our ghetto, from previous transports. And my father recognized one of them. He said, "Name is Beryl." I said, "Beryl, where are we? What is this? Where are we?" And he said to my dad, this is Auschwitz. This is a death camp. You're all going to be gassed and killed today and burned probably tomorrow. But don't scream, don't cry. There's nothing you can do. You can't escape. Just say your prayers. I heard that. I held my father's hand. But I didn't want to start crying because my dad couldn't help me. I didn't even squeeze his hand. I didn't even want him to know that I heard what I heard. And I couldn't believe that I was going to die at 10 years old. I didn't do anything bad. I was good to my mother. I always helped at home. I chopped wood. I brought water from the river. When I was thinking, I could see there was two crematoriums right there. There was Birkenau. You can see the flames even coming out through the tall chimneys and the smoke and the heavy stench of flesh burning. They knew what it was because somebody should burn your hand or a finger. And you know, it smells like flesh burning. And I began thinking, how much longer have I got to live? 5 minutes? 10 minutes? 15 minutes? Is this all there is? By that time, a command was given, column left face and forward march. And the column began marching towards the left. My daughter and I were near the end. Then I could see the column make a right turn to the gates of the crematorium. And I kept thinking, how much longer will I live? Just maybe 5 minutes to go to the crematorium, maybe 5 minutes to get undressed. I don't know how long it takes to be gassed, maybe 5 minutes or 3 minutes. And just as I was thinking, my turn came to pivot and to go into the gate. To the right, there was an SS commander and two lieutenants. And when I looked to the right to see what's inside the gate, I saw this Gestapo with ladies. All the hair shaved off, striped dresses, just prisoner dresses, long dresses. And they're playing music, violins, and cellos, Strauss waltzes. Felt like you're going to a concert. And in the background, way in the background, I could see there was a pile of bodies, dead bodies. And I saw wheelbarrows with people pushing the wheelbarrows of dead bodies to the pile. But people got gassed quicker than you could burn them. So piles accumulated. I was only a few feet from the gate where the German officer took the cane with the curved handle by the bottom and put it around my neck and pulled me out of line. My dad held my hand so he also came. Then he pulled another one out of line and another one out of line. By the time the transport got in, 11 of us were left outside the gate of the crematorium. All the rest were gassed and burned that night. My father and I and the other nine were given tattoos, numbers on their arms, and were put into the camp to wait, to work.
And so you actually were forced to work there in the camp.
That's right. So every day it was reveille at 5 o'clock. Then we had to stand up at attention to be counted. And as we were counted, sometimes the count was not exact, and they had to do a recount. And we'd stand there for hours. While the count continued, we had a standard attention. We're facing east. I was watching the sun rise. And I'd say to myself, God, thank you for letting me live this extra day. Today I would live. I don't know about tomorrow. When I come back from work, I might get hurt. I might be tired. I might be shot. I might be big. I might get sick. But I have today. And luckily, I didn't die that day. So the next day, I get up again. Same thing. So again, I thank God for the second day. I wound up being there with my father. We took many beatings and we were sick for about 330 or 40 days. I don't remember exactly.
That's sort of the idea of the last sunrise, because you never knew when that would be the
every
last
day,
sunrise.
I thought I was watching the last sunrise, the last day of my life. Can you imagine? It's like being on death row.
Well, of course, you had committed no crime at all. The only crime, only thing was you'd been born Jewish, and they were exterminating the Jews there.
That's exactly right.
Now, of course, after 300 and some odd days, well, what happened? You were actually then...
Well, what happened, there was a call, and they needed tailors to go work somewhere. My grandfather was a tailor. My father was a barber. So I raised my hand. I'm a tailor. So did you come? So my father raised his hand, too. So he took us. They took us to another camp called the Renningburg. They had to put me in a buttonhole machine to make buttonholes for German uniforms. didn't have time to learn to use a buttonhole machine. And this is how I got out of Auschwitz. Of course, Orenburg is another story. And would you like me to go on?
Sure, you please go right ahead.
The rest of Orenburg, there was a German, I didn't know what it was, but it was a German base, an Army Air Force base. It was a Messerschmitt factory there underneath the ground. We didn't know what it was there. And we would just carry concrete and dig ditches and build reinforcements and do manual labor. And we would stay in barracks. There's barracks like hangars. They were straw on the floor. We never got undressed, and that's where we would stay at night. Well, about every day, a siren would sound, and airplanes would come overhead. And when the siren was sounding, everyone had to lay down and get inside those hangars. There was American planes, I think it was B-17s. They were 30 miles from Berlin, so they were heading to Berlin. You could hear by the engines that had heavy loads. The engines were sort of humming with, like under heavy load. And then they'd pass Oranienburg, and then they'd say, all clear, would get out and go back to work. Then about a half an hour later, the siren would sound again because the planes would return. And this time they were much lighter. They dropped the bombs in Berlin. And you can hear by the sound that they dropped the bombs in Berlin, because the sound of the engines was different than it was than when they came. Well, one Sunday morning, the same thing happened, and the planes came, and the siren sounded, and we were hiding in the bunker, and then it was all clear, and then about half an hour later, we planes coming back again, returning, and they had this. I said to my dad, it sounds like they didn't get a chance to drop their bomb. I wonder what happened. I wonder if they were chased away. And just about then, we heard bombs falling and explosions. And what we learned later, there were a young forest with pine trees, but underneath the ground, there was a Messerschmitt factory. So the American bombers destroyed the Messerschmitt factory. They didn't drop the bombs on the hangars where we were, where normally kept planes. So there must have been some good intelligence there. But since there were no more use for us, sent us to another camp. Sent us to Dachau.
All right, of course, now that is just outside of Munich. I was there after the war. And, of course, this was sort of the end of the road. It's getting towards the end of the war at this point, isn't it?
That's right. It was end of 93, beginning of 43. Beginning of
44. So what happened at Dachau? You were forced to work there or what?
In Dachau, there was a horrible camp also. It was cold. There was no food, and there was no water, and we worked 12 hours a day. And what they did was that they took about 5,000 people out every day to march down 10 miles or more on foot, and then to unload trains of cement, drop them into mixers, then we would mix it later, carry it in buckets, and build a defense line to prevent the Allied tanks from coming into Munich. So this is what we do all day long. My job was to carry cement on my back, 50 pounders. And every time I picked up a sack of cement, the powder, from the sack, which was slammed all over my head, and with all the sweat on my head and all over my body, the cement would harden on my hair. It almost felt like a helmet. You had to kind of break it off and pull the hair out with it. Then it was like this for almost the whole year, and I don't know how we made it, because people were just ending their lives, grabbing the wires, electrified wires. They couldn't go on anymore. I mean, the work was horrible. You saw movies and pictures how skinny and thin the people were. You couldn't even see their stomachs. It was just skeletons covered with bone. And I was like that too, but I was still able to walk. So then on April 30th, three significant things happened in my life. One was Hitler gave the order to destroy all German towns because it was near the end of the war, and to kill all the remaining political prisoners, which I was a political prisoner, to kill them, to take them to Tyrol, to the mountain, to shoot them there by gunshot. And the same day, Hitler committed suicide, April 30, 1945. And on the same day, that afternoon, the Allies, American division, came upon Dachau and liberated the camp. What they found was trains full of dead people that were locked up and didn't go anywhere, just in trains. They found people barely alive on the ground, just couldn't even get up, thousands of them. And we were on a march to the road to be shot. Well, we didn't know that, but that's where we were going. On the third day into the march, and of course there was SS on both sides, making you go fast, making you go slow, beating you. And on the third day, we saw two small planes in the sky. And they must have spotted our column, so they dove down, and one plane dropped a bomb behind us, the column. The big column was 10,000 people. The other one dropped one in front of it, and it came down a very low level.
Yeah, these were American planes.
I didn't know then, but they were American planes. The SS gave the order, everyone to hit the ground to get down, and the SS troops also went down in the ditches. So, of course, I never saw a plane before. My curiosity, I was ready to die just to look at them. So I could see the planes coming down right over treetop levels. I could almost touch them. They were green fuselage with a white star painted on it. So I knew it wasn't German. It had to be American or British. And as it flew past us, I could see the pilot. I could see his goggles and his brown leather hat, his brown leather jacket with the lateral collar. I could even see the patch on his shoulder. And he looked on both sides, and he saw there was a bunch of prisoners, so they quickly took off and got up in the sky, maybe 20,000 or 10,000 feet. The SS, there was a clearing. The SS says, get up, get out, let's move out, and we're going to try and move us out of the way to get us into hide a little further. Well, the two planes came along again, turned around, and again order was given to hit the ground, everyone get down, and then again, of course, I didn't get down, and I could see the American planes beginning to shoot, to strafe the SS and the ditches. I saw that. I could see the bullets come out of the planes. I looked to the right, I saw a forest about 300 yards away. I start running to the forest, and my father started following me. And then a few other people started to run. And then maybe even 100 or more started to run to that forest. The planes took off and they never returned. The SS began shouting, everyone come back, or we'll shoot, come back. And I kept running as fast as my little skinny legs would take me. And again they shouted, we'll shoot, come back. Zurück in German, I understood German. And I could hear bullets whistling by my ear. I could see people falling on both sides. I could see people raising their hands, turning around and going back. And I was only 50 feet from the trees. I said, God, if you only can make it another few minutes, I'll be at the trees and I'll be safe. I've asked to get hit. I hope I could hit in my shoulder and my arm and not in my leg, because I got hit in the leg. I wouldn't be able to run. And what I was thinking, I was right at the trees with my father and a few other people. The SS gathered whatever they could. They didn't have enough time to go look for everybody. They took the column to Tyrol, where everyone was executed. We stayed in the forest for 3 days and 3 nights. There was only 5 of us left. My father and me and 3 other people. We didn't eat. We had nowhere to go. It was cold. It was May. It was still cold. We drank water from melting snow. But on the third day, I said to my dad, I hear tanks And I said, I don't hear anything. So I went on the ground, put my ear to the ground, and I could hear tanks. So we got to the edge of the forest while hiding behind the trees and observed the road that we just recently passed only 3 days ago with a transport. We could see the American trains slowly coming up the road, an entire column of it. And my dad and I and three others began running to the tanks. The Americans took us on the tanks, gave us food, and took us into Munich. I was with them for a year. My father and I was with them for a year. My father was a barber, so we gave him a haircut. And I used to do KP, clean pots and pans and peel potatoes. I had all the food I wanted.
That was quite a change from where it had been.
Yeah, a lot of change. I had all the food I wanted. The Americans were throwing away so much of the food. I couldn't believe that so much was being thrown away. They used to take those empty ration cans, those big iron cans, put a couple of holes in either side and use a wire, put a wire through them, and between peeling potatoes and cleaning pots and pans, I would take them out and sell them to the German starving population, mostly just women and children. I used to get a quarter for a can or so, and it saved their lives. And my dad used to get tips from the soldiers, American soldiers. And there was one soldier there from Chicago that was Polish, so we were able to speak with him. We gave him the money that we had to change. He sent it to his father and converted it into US dollars. His father from Chicago sent it to my uncle in Los Angeles. And at the end of the year's time in Germany and being with them, it was $1,000 saved up, which paid for a passage to come to America. So we paid our own way. And by the way, I've never collected welfare or unemployment. Always paid taxes and always supported my family.
And of course, then you, but eventually, of course, you had to give up the bitterness, the anger, the hatred that you had, of course, because of really the terrible time. Why did you finally decide to stop hating and decide just to go on with your life?
Well, that's a very important question, and I'm glad that you brought it up. While I was in camp, particularly in Dachau, and I saw people going for the wires, ending their life, I kept praying to God, and said, God, if you let me live, I promise to take revenge. I will kill every Nazi. If a German crosses my path, I will make him pay for taking my family from me and for leaving me without a burial site to even visit. And you just let me live, and I'll do it. If I live, I will do it. I'll take revenge. Well, the war ended, as I said, and I lived, and I began thinking how many Nazis can I kill before I die. But what would happen to me? I would probably die in the process, too. I would be like a terrorist. So I said to God, in my mind, of course, as God, please forgive me for not keeping the promise. I have another thought in my mind. I will go ahead and raise a family. I will memorize my mother, memorialize my mother and my brother and all the people in my book by telling my story. I will build a good life for myself. I'll go to school. I'll get a job. I'll raise a family so that the children, for them to remember my story and what happened to their ancestors. And so it was. I was in business for 37 years in Union Oil, service station and automotive repairs that I learned in Germany after the war, by the way. And when I retired, I decided now it's time to tell my story, to write the book. And I've been doing public service for the last 10, 11 years, speaking to churches of all denominations, schools, all levels of education, spoke to over 30,000 people. And I have hundreds and hundreds of letters from people whose lives it has changed and who have benefited from my comments.
Well, it's a powerful, powerful book that really can change lives. And certainly you can see, as I read that, I thought, you know, God really had his hand on you for a specific purpose, for a specific time, perhaps to preach the message that you preach today, which is, of course, we can't carry hatred. Hatred will destroy us.
Dr. Stein, I also want to mention to you and to your audience that this is probably going to be the last radio show that I do. I'm ending my speaking tours because it's going to be too painful for me to continue with this message. Although the book will be out and videos will be out. And I've just done about as much as I could do.
Well, I want to thank you so much for being willing to come on with us several times. And others, we actually have a number of interviews with Mr. Gordon before this one, but it's a message that is so important, and we do have it recorded, and it is available through Radio Liberty. Thank you so much for being with us, Mr. Gordon. I really appreciate you being with us tonight.
You're welcome.
Good night, and God bless you. Well, I hope you've enjoyed the program we presented, and Mr. Gordon has been very kind to come on with us. But of course, it's very hard for him to talk about certain things that happened. If you'd like to hear some of the other interviews, we have them, or maybe you'd like to get a copy of this. People say, "Well, how did that happen?" Well, you have to understand there is evil. There are evil forces in the world today. And what motivated the Hitler's Germany was the occult. Hitler was deeply involved in the occult. The SS, you remember the Skull and Crossbones, they were really an occult organization. Of course, they are motivated by Satan, by evil. And until you understand that, you can't understand what happened in Hitler's Germany, nor can you understand what is going on in America today. Because the same spiritual forces that in Hitler's Germany are here today in America. If you have not yet read Erwin Lutzer's wonderful book, Hitler's Cross, Erwin Lutzer is a senior pastor at the Moody Bible Church in Chicago, and he writes about what happened to the church in Germany, how they were preaching Romans 13. Romans 13, you're just to be subservient to the state. Exactly like is being preached here in America today, and how the ministers simply compromised their principles to get along, and they went right along with the authoritarian society that was, of course, waging war against the world. What's the similarity between what's going on in the world today? Well, if any of you really believe that we went to Iraq and we're going to be coming home in the next year or so, as soon as we establish a democracy, you really don't understand. We are planning on being there at least 10 years, probably much, much longer. Permanent stationed in the Middle East. And, of course, the tragedy is American soldiers are involved, of course, forcing the Iraqis to go along. There are going to be atrocities on both sides, tragedies on both sides, American soldiers shooting innocent Iraqis, terrorists shooting innocent Americans, and the war will drag on and on and on, I fear. But, of course, I believe God will bring his judgment upon this country because men and women become accomplices to the evils they fail to oppose. And so our plea to you is, understand what's going on. Learn about the spiritual battle. Get our book, The Brotherhood of Darkness. And, of course, seriously consider supporting the Radio Liberty family of supporters. And if you would like to get in touch with us, if you'd like to get a free copy of our newsletter, or you'd like to join the Radio Liberty family, our telephone number is 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. And never believe that it cannot happen here. I have material coming down off the web where they talk about, and I'm talking about Gorbachev and Marie Strong and working together. Marie Strong, of course, a wealthy capitalist. Gorbachev, the former head of the KGB, the former dictator of Russia, the former butcher of Afghanistan, working together with a discussion on the Earth Charter, and where they're talking about how they'll have to identify people with fundamentalist religions and how they'll have to be eliminated. You say, don't think, believe that's real? Well, if you can just give us a call, we'd be glad to send you that page. I hope one of these days we'll be able to put that up on our website so people will really understand what indeed is going on today. We're involved in a spiritual battle being fought on a political, ideological, and cultural battlefield, a spiritual battle for the hearts and minds of men. Pray for America and pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. And so until tomorrow, may the Lord be with you. This is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not necessarily of those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And of course, we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls, because we have this in studio this evening, Jeannie Soderman. Hi, Jeannie. How are you doing?
I'm fine, Dr. Stan.
And Jeannie is sitting over here with three-ring binders and piles of material. And what are we going to be talking about this evening?
Well, I still would like to do the correlation between the Soviet parallel government that's being formed in the United States and the analogy to the miniseries of the movie America that was shown on TV in 1987.
All right, well, you go right ahead.
When I saw the movie, it's a fiction, they say, of America. And it has to do when America had been occupied by foreign troops for 10 years. And the year was 1997. I realized that back in 1954, there was a Congressional Race Commission that investigated private foundations. And Norman Dodd went to the president of the Ford Foundation and was investigating that particular foundation. And the president of the Ford Foundation, Rowan Gaither, said to Norman Dodd at that time, and this is a quote because it's so important to understand what's happening in the United States of America now. Quote, "We operate here under directives which emulate from the White House. The substance of the directives under which we operate is that we shall use our grant-making power to alter life in the United States such that we can comfortably be merged with the Soviet Union." And there's one other quote he did say, quote, "The task is to covertly lower the standard of living, the whole social structure of America, so that we can be merged with all other nations."
And of course, this is really what's going on today. They don't want to tell the American people that, but their plan really is to lower our living standards here in the United States. And I saw this written up in the Socialist International, the official publication of the Socialist International. Of course, they publish Socialist Affairs. The CFR publishes Foreign Affairs. The Communists publish Political Affairs. The Royal Institute of International Relations publishes International Affairs. It's sort of an inside joke. You see, they're all working together towards the same goal. But we can't let the American people know that, because, after all, the Communists are our enemies, aren't they? So, but back in 1982, the Socialist International was talking about the Americans have so much money, what we need to do is redistribute their wealth to the rest of the world. And I remember reading that and saying, the American people would never go along with that. And yet they're going along with it today. We're shipping our factories all over the world, and they're being actually subsidized and encouraged by tax laws to move out of this country, whether moving into Malaysia, or whether moving into Mexico, or whether moving into China. We are in the process of transferring America's jobs, both blue-collar and white-collar jobs, to other countries. And, of course, as time goes by, we'll gradually lower the living standards of the American people. And, of course, one reason why they're building the relocation camps is they anticipate there'll be rioting and unrest in our cities. But don't you worry, if that ever happens, why you'll be branded as a terrorist. That's what the Patriot Act is all about. That's what the Office of Homeland Security is all about, to establish an authoritarian society in the name of course, maintaining our freedom.
I'd like to go back to the video that was on TV for only one time, and it played for 12 hours in 1987. It was a mini-series. As soon as America with a K was played for 12 hours, it was taken off TV.
And never played again.
Never played again. And also, at that time in 1987, I have an acquaintance that went down to the bookstore and said, do you have a book called America with a K? And the bookstore had 12 issues. And he said, I would like to buy 12 books. And they said, no, you can only have one. We are shipping back all the rest to the publisher.
Now, of course, this is a pretty standard procedure. What they do is the publisher calls them back, and they either don't circulate the books or they destroy them. They've done that with many books that, of course, the CIA or the establishment doesn't want the American people to read. I remember they did that with Monica Jensen Stevens's book, Kiss the Boys Goodbye. And, of course, when it was republished up in Canada, they just accidentally shredded 5,000 copies.
Well, the people that put out this particular video, America, was ABC Capital Cities. And there is a good faction of the CIA that's still out there. And I believe they wanted to get the word out to the American people. This is what is going to happen if you don't wake up. And so this movie, America, is so emotional. It goes into all the philosophy of what is being done to the American people now, and also how the Soviets think, and also the people behind the Soviets. So when you look at a problem, it's not what you usually see, but what is around the corner that is there. And so here again, America is the time. It actually shows in The Breadbasket, in starring Robert Urich, and he played the county administrator in Milford, Nebraska. And Robert Urich, I'm sure you remember him, Dr. Stan. I just looked at his obituary, and he passed away in April of 2002, just over a year ago. He was only 55.
He was a football player. He was really very, he always seemed like a really nice guy.
He was a very handsome, very nice, very family oriented. And they, in this obituary, they named all the movies he was in, all the television series, and not one word of the video, America, that was missing. So they want to keep this under taps because the script from this movie and the book, I believe, is so real and so close to what is happening in America now that they want to put this under the rug and not even talk about it. In the beginning of the movie, there is a Soviet colonel that says something that's very, very telling. And it's quoted here. He says, America has lost. You had political freedom, but you lost your passion. How could we not win? And so that gets you thinking of the people now today. They're so involved with their work, with their sports, that you go to a meeting and everything is controlled. And if you're passionate at a meeting, they say, well, you're being aggressive. And of course, that's the Delphi technique, the consensus, where they want you to agree with everyone. And you cannot use passion because then you're not cooperating with everyone. You have to cooperate. Well, they should go to England and look at the Parliament and see how they cooperate with each other. It's not pleasant, it's not quiet, and they shout at each other. This is what has happened in America through the Delphi technique, is we have lost a passion to be able to speak up for our rights and what we believe in.
And of course, what Jeannie, I think, is describing is a very carefully planned technique using television, using radio, using other major means of communication to change the attitude of the American people, to make them forget about what individualism and freedom is about. They're doing this in our churches now with the small groups. Everything is the group. The group becomes much more important than the individual. You become part of the group. But of course, if you disagree at all, then you are a defector, you're a detractor. You have to be eliminated. You will be put out of the group, you'll lose your friends. And of course, this is the technique being used in churches, being used in business, used in many organizations like the Masons, for instance. You better go along and just don't rock the boat.
That's true. You're going to go along with the community, and the community is the group, and that's what they're using right now, is the homeowners associations. And there's a little small town that I live in, La Selva Beach in California, beautiful little town, but what is happening there, it's all controlled by the socialist Marxists. You'd be surprised that it's not the real strong businessmen that actually control that community. It's the little old ladies that smile at you and say, good morning. And so there again, the attitude is you get along with the community or you don't belong there, and they kind of ostracize you.
And of course, these are the people who 50 years ago were going to college, when I was going to college, indoctrinated in these Marxist concepts, and they never grew up, and they never realized, of course, that socialism really doesn't work. Socialism is an elitist concept. It's not redistributing the wealth. Of course, it's centralizing all power with an elite who will control everything. And of course, whether it be at the local level or at the national level, the reason that people of great wealth push socialism is so that you can centralize power and the government can take care of us common folks, but then who is it who controls the government? Why, the people who have enough money to buy and sell politicians. That's what socialism is really all about.
In the miniseries, America, it does portray Chris Christopherson. He was the candidate for the 1988 presidential election. And he didn't go along with what they call the New America, the New Politics. And he was put in a prison for 6 years. And he went to a prison camp in Southwest Texas. It was called Fort Davis. And it shows at the beginning of the film where he's coming out and he has to make a pledge in front of everyone before he goes out into society. And the pledge is done in front of a flag. And the flag is very interesting because it has the United Nations symbol. It's blue, and the United Nations flag in the middle. On the left-hand side is the Russian flag, the hammer and the sickle, and on the right-hand side is the American flag. So they're all attached together. And this is so important because this is the actual pledge that he does say. Quote, I pledge my allegiance to this flag with the community of American, Soviet, and United Nations of the world, and to the principle for which it stands, a nation indivisible with others in the earth, enjoined in peace and justice for all. Now, we say under God. God has been taken out of the pledge. And throughout the whole movie of America, there is no mention of religion, no mention of God. It starts where Robert Urich is the county administrator, And that's a very important job because he coordinates everything in the community. And it's interesting where he's at home and he has a daughter studying Western history. And they give little snippets like Robert Urich says his name is really Peter Bradford. He says to his daughter, what are you studying? And she says, well, Western history. And Robert Urich says, theirs or ours? So it's little snippets like that that brings to mind what's happening in our schools, because they are changing our history in the textbooks in all the schools.
No, sure. In fact, they don't teach the Declaration of Independence, where it says, of course, we hold these truths to be self-evident that all men are created equal and endowed by their Creator. They'll just say, we hold these truths to be self-evident. All men are created equal, dot, 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 dot. And, of course, they have certain unalienable rights, among which are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And, of course, they leave out by endowed by their Creator. Why? Because they don't want these children to understand that the whole philosophy of America was built upon the fact that there was a God. And, of course, whether referring to nature's God and nature's law or the supreme ruler of the universe or a divine authority, all of these are phrases that are used in the Declaration of Independence. But of course, this is not to be mentioned in our schools today, because of course, the whole idea was to change us from being one nation under God to a secular nation and then ultimately into a pagan nation. And of course, by destroying the religious foundation of America, you destroy America. That's why the Supreme Court took God and prayer out of our school, to change us from a Christian nation to a nation with no foundation at all. And what will men fight for if they're not fighting for God and country? They're not going to fight for a country alone. They're not going to fight for materialism. They have to have a religious fervor. And, of course, they're systematically removing that from the very thoughts of our people.
Well, in one of the scenes in the movie America, the young girl, the daughter of Peter Bradford, which is Robert Urich, and her boyfriend, there was a very touching scene, and the boyfriend says, we don't know what we're for or what we're against. And it brought to mind the constitutional classes, that we should understand what our Constitution says, what our Bill of Rights say, and there again we have to understand what we're fighting for, because if we don't have a cause, then we're lost. We need something to believe in.
And that, of course, is why we're encouraging people to set up an Institute of the Constitution and learn our Constitution and Bill of Rights and the Declaration of Independence and understand that we are the only nation, in almost 3,000 years that pledged its allegiance to God, that founded its very existence upon the Word of God.
Now, they talked about in the movie America, with a K, regarding advisory committees. And the Russian Colonel Andrei said, the wonderful thing about advisory committees, you can always tell them what to advise. And this is what I have found in Santa Cruz County. You can go down the list of all the advisory committees, and they have a committee for everything. You've got water, you've got housing, children, women, you name it. There's an advisory committee. I happen to follow the water advisory committee. And it's very interesting because it is completely controlled by the people who understand what the agenda is. We had a meeting the other day. They had guests coming in, the principal planner, Mark Deming, and then we had the John Ricker from the head of environmental health, and then we had, Daniels from the Soquel Creek Water Board. And they came up with all these wonderful ideas of global warming, precautionary principle. And I thought, and I spoke up when I heard precautionary principle. I said, that's out of the biodiversity treaty. Does that mean you're following international law? not a word was spoken after that, because they understood that I knew that they were actually implementing and implementing international law by the treaties.
And I think what people have to understand is all of these ideas come down from international bodies, where it could be the World Bank Water Policy or the Biodiversity Treaty or whatever, another United Nations Commission. And these ideas are filtered down to the local community, and then they're picked up by the local community and enacted. The whole idea is to use control of water to control people. To repeat over and over again, there's a shortage of water, we have saltwater intrusion, never try to solve the problem, spend hundreds of thousands of dollars studying the problem and studying the problem, but never build a reservoir or a holding tank or anything at all to solve the problem, maintain the problem, give the impression you're doing something, and in truth, you want the problem, because that, of course, gives you a purpose and the ability to control the public.
Well, they also want to go into a regional water bank, and that means they want water coming in and then water going out of the Santa Cruz area. Why SoCal Creek Water District is so important, they have a lot of water, and most of that is groundwater, and they want the groundwater, they want control of the private water wells. And this is what the County Board of Supervisors tried to do about a year and a half ago, to put meters on the private water wells. Well, we had about 400 people down at the county building, and people were calling, recall, recall, and boy, do they back up. But unfortunately, with these elitists, and they think they know how to control us and what we should eat and what we should think, they have...
And what we should drink, too, because by they really only intend, what is it, 10 gallons of water a day or something like that?
10 and a half gallons.
That's already planned out at the international level. That would give you about 2 good flushes of your toilet.
Yes.
And then there'd be no water to drink or to wash or to do anything else with.
Right. Which reminds me of the film America with a K, the miniseries. Amanda, who's the wife of the county administrator, she's in the kitchen, and she's got a bucket of water on the kitchen floor, and she's got a ladle, and she's putting water in the ladle up to the pot on the stove. And I'm thinking, doesn't she have running water in her home? And so that's what it's coming to. She's actually using a sewing machine, and it's one of these manual treadle sewing machines where you actually pump it with your feet. In fact, I have my old grandmother's sewing machine. It's not electric. So everything was manual that they were doing on the farm.
You know, of course, the whole idea of this environmental movement is to do away with electricity, to cut back on the use of electricity, to get us out of our cars, to stop us using energy, to control everything we do, and take us back, you know, to the way it was. Really, if you read the biodiversity Global Biodiversity Assessment, they want to take us back to the way it was before the white man came to this country. You say, that's madness. Well, you need to get their documents. Certainly, Jeannie has actually summarized the Global Biodiversity Assessment report that came out of the Second Earth Summit in 1992. That's in our Sustainable Development Syllabus, and if you don't have it, you need to get it. Or go down and buy the Global Biodiversity Assessment. You can order that from your local bookstore. It'll cost you $60. It's 1,152 pages of gobbledygook. But if you read it carefully, you'll find what they really want is to take us back the way it was before the wicked white man came.
Well, that brings a question, is if they want to bring us back to 1492, do they want to get rid of the white men? Or I'm sure there's going to be a cadre of elitists, that they're the enlightened ones and they're needed to control the other people, which brings to mind they're planning to build sustainable communities. And we have the plan in South Carolina, by this wonderful woman called Kay McClanahan, and she wrote such a wonderful piece in DeWeese's report regarding the plan that they want to implement in her county. And what it includes is sustainable villages, but they're going to be different types. There's going to be a village that already has the infrastructure, and this will be the upgraded village. This is where the elitists will live. They'll have all the amenities, nice homes, but they'll be crowded together still. So this will be one type of village. The second village, and there's going to be buffer zones around the villages. We have seen documents where the buffer zones, it looks like they're going to have 3 miles of green space of buffer zones around the villages. The second type of village will be for people who do manual work. And they will actually travel from that village into the upper class village, and they'll work for the elitists, or they'll create industry in that village. And so there's your second village. The third village I really find just devastating. It will be with no infrastructure, and these are the people that are not productive, and they don't have jobs. And that kind of correlates with the movie America, because what they had outside of the regular town in Milford, Nebraska, that was where America was the scene, is they have camps called squatters' camps. And these camps where you had old trailers, you had tents, you had lean-tos, shacks, and these were the people that they brought to these areas, and they were called exiles because they did not go along with the new America, with the new policy of the socialist America. A lot of these people came from the city. They were city people, and they did not know how to take care of themselves. And I believe that this third sustainable village will be where they put the squatters and the people that do not go along with the philosophy of the socialists.
Well, I think anybody who has any serious question as to what Jeannie's talking about needs to get the Agenda 21 master plan for the Monterey, Santa Cruz, Monterey Bay area. And it's all there. You know, we're going to have our sustainable communities, and we're going to, of course, have toll roads on Highway 17 because we don't want people coming here. And eventually, of course, we won't even need those roads because we're going to get the people out of the cars. It's all there. And, of course, the Agenda 21 for Santa Cruz, voted on by your Board of Supervisors, of course, without the knowledge or consent of the people, and totally suppressed by the local newspapers and even many of the radio stations. This local Agenda 1 program, it just happens to correspond almost identically to the Global Biodiversity Assessment, the Agenda 21 program that was laid out internationally. And so it's laid out internationally, and then in communities all across America, all across the world, these are adopted. But the one here in Santa Cruz was one of the pioneer ones, because Santa Cruz has always been an experiment for these socialist ideas. If you'd like to get the Agenda 21 report, it is available through Radio Liberty. You really need to get that. You need to get our sustainable development syllabus. You need to understand they really do a plan to put the people into sustainable villages. Is that right, Jeannie?
Oh, definitely. The local Agenda 21, it's an interesting history. In 1990, there was a ballot put on in Santa Cruz County, and it was for the environment. It was called Measure C, Decade of the Environment, and it was to be for 10 years, from 1990 to 2000. Well, when the year 2000 came up, the Board of Supervisors had two options. They could either readopt it, or they could put it on the ballot for the citizens to vote. They didn't want the citizens to vote. They readopted Measure C, Agenda 21, for another 10 years.
We'll be right back here in just a moment and welcome your calls at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and those of you who are listening out there say these things could not be true. I mean, if they had a program like this for Santa Cruz, a master plan that is not known to anybody other than the people on the Board of Supervisors and the small clique of internationalists from the United Nations Committee and some of the people from the local socialist and Marxist movement, why this couldn't be true. Well, we have it. It's available. You give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's the Santa Cruz Agenda 21. Of course, on the front page is a letter from Sam Farr congratulating the people and saying what a good job they did with this. And, of course, if you ask Sam Farr about this, well, he'll say, I never heard of it. I never heard of it.
Well, he doesn't want a dialogue. That's the problem. And that's with the same is the supervisors, Ellen Peary. We talk about Agenda 21, and she'll kind of shift away from that because she now, I've gone to several Aptos meetings and Corralitos meetings, and one, I'm videoing all the meetings, and in one meeting, someone asked Ellen Peary if she believes in private property. And she said yes to a certain extent. Interesting answer. And then the question comes to how much of an extent do you believe in private property? How many regulations do you want on private property? And so I thought that answer was very interesting because I do have it on videotape. This America with a K, the miniseries video that was on TV, it's very interesting because there's an advisory committee. And Chris Christopherson, he has an ex-wife, Marion. Now, she is on the National Advisory Council. And what this council does is they counsel and advise the president and the Congress. And that brought to mind, excuse me, the U.S. Commission on National Security of the 21st Century report. There was phase one and two, but in phase three, that was how they were going to change the roles of the executive in the legislative branches. And I remember reading that phase three report, and it said they were going to bring in advisors for especially the congressmen, because the congressmen didn't really understand the international arena. And so they have to be brought up to snuff of what's happening in the international arena. And they would take congressmen, and every year they would have to go to another country to understand what was happening internationally. So this National Advisory Council, I believe, is already here, has been here for many years when they implemented the National Security Agency. We have a National Security Advisor. And through my research, I really believe this is the person that coordinates the Russian government, the United States government, and bringing them in, as we had seen at the beginning of the program, that they were going to merge the United States and they were going to merge the Soviet Union in with the United States.
Well, of course, we're merging everything into this one world government. Of course, Russia being the other major superpower with a massive nuclear force. In fact, they have far more nuclear warheads than we do. And of course, we are unilaterally disarming and they're in full production for war. What's wrong with this picture? Because we're subsidizing them so they can build up their military as we unilaterally disarm. Something seriously wrong with the picture.
SS, It's an interesting term in Hitler's days. It means the Schutzstaffel. And if you look in your German dictionary, Schutz is protection, and Staffel is home defense squadron. And so what we have now is very similar to the SS. And in the movie America with a K, they had the same type of military men in black, and they had helmets over their faces so you couldn't see their face. And they were actually doing peacekeeping exercises. And it's very similar to what's happening in America now, where all the countries are coming together and doing peacekeeping exercises. So everything in this movie, the script is just horrendous, because if you read the book, you have the script, and it was telling too much what was going to happen in the future. There's one scene in the America with a K movie where Marion, she's the one in the National Advisory Council, and she's come to see, she has two sons, one son, Caleb, and he is picture perfect of what you would call blue-eyed, blonde, and he just loves the socialist America. And she comes into the classroom, and the teacher is talking about a philosophy. And she mentioned that when the Americans conquered the continent, they killed a lot of Indians. They believed in survival of the fittest, that is, the corporations, the companies, the government, and the bosses. And the teacher asked, what philosophy was this called? And there was a long pause, and Marion from the advisory council said, social Darwinism, which means everyone took of themselves and didn't care for nobody else. Do you have a comment on that, Dr. Stan?
Well, that, of course, social Darwinism would be the survival of the fittest. But, of course, the only way a society can survive is to have moral people in it. And, of course, that really was the very essence of America when we were founded. You know, it was to be a moral country, and as John Adams had said, you know, our country was built upon moral and religious principles. You know, it would not survive for any other. The only way we could have limited government was to have moral people. If we didn't have moral people, and then of course we would have to have an authoritarian society, or as William Penn had said so well, those will not be ruled by God, will be ruled by tyrants. Of course, the description, of course, that she's given is one where there are no moral principles at all. Certainly there were was injustice. Certainly the Indians were badly treated. But as we pointed out so many times before, there have always been two forces here in the United States. One was the Christian, the other was the occult or the evil. And of course, I fear that many of the things, many of the atrocities that we've seen carried out, certainly all the wars that have been fought almost going back to the very inception of this country, were created by these evil people who, of course, their ultimate goal has always been a world socialist system, the New World Order, the New World Religion.
Well, that goes right along with Devin. This is Chris Christopherson that came out of the Gulag camp in Texas. And this is what he said, quote, "We didn't lose it on the field of battle. We lost it in our hearts. We lost it in our lack of courage, women against men, old against young, special interests, corporate interests, etc. Above all, we must blame it on our failure as individuals to take responsibility for moral choice." So that goes right along what you said, Dr. Stan.
Perhaps that's really very, very beautifully said, because, of course, You know, if we do not have moral people, then of course we will lose our freedom. And does anybody watch television today and really think that we're still a moral nation? Imagine if you were a Muslim watching American television. You would say that indeed is the great Satan.
Mm-hmm.
And the tragedy is, of course, this does not represent the way a lot of people feel here. But unfortunately, the good people will not speak up. The church will not speak up. And of course, we are in terrible, terrible problems today because this country has turned against God, and no country that's ever turned against God has ever survived.
In the movie America with a K, Devin, who is coming out of the prison camp, is in front of the judge. And the judge says to Devin, "You will reside in a 25-mile radius of your father's home, which you'll be staying with. If you are caught outside the prescribed area, you will be shot on sight, and you are to report once a week to the county administrative office." And at that point, I thought, oh, report to Susan Mariello? I don't think so. But it was just a thought that just fleeted through the mine. But it's interesting because in the train station, it was one of the most heartbreaking scenes where Devin is coming to meet his brother. And there was a sign in the train station that said administrative travel permit required for outside 25-mile perimeter. So it does look like eventually there'll be internal passes and you must have a permit to go further than 25 miles or a certain...
We know it's very interesting, Jeannie, that in the name of fighting terrorism, we're all going to be color-coded as far as our ability to fly. And of course, if you have a red or an orange, if you have, if you're a red, why, of course, you won't be able to, allowed to fly in America at all. And if you're an orange, why, of course, you'll be closely scrutinized and checked and evaluated. And of course, this is all in the name of fighting terrorism under this new Homeland Security and Patriot Act. But of course, what have they done? There's not one word about Islamic terrorism. They've redefined the word terrorism. Terrorism could mean, of course, you'd have violated some federal law, or maybe you were an abortion protester, or maybe, of course, you'd been charged with something else. In fact, in the Patriot Act, you don't even have to be convicted of anything, but if you might be guilty or you could be perceived as being guilty, of course, then you would be treated as if you were guilty. And people do not understand that ultimately down the line, they intend to limit our ability to travel. That's really what getting us out of our cars is about. That's what, of course, putting the toll roads on Highway 17 is about. That's what the color coding they're coming up with now for air travel. People say, this could never happen in America. This all has to do with the war on terrorism. Well, if it really has to do with the war on terrorism, why don't any of the legislation talk about Islamic terrorism? If we're really involved in a war on terrorism, why haven't they sealed our southern borders? If we're really involved in a war on terrorism, why haven't they armed all of our airline pilots instead, as of about 200 as of this morning? If we're really involved with a war on terrorism, why didn't they put air marshals onto all the planes immediately? Why are they waiting 2 years and suddenly beginning to talk about, well, gee, maybe we're going to have to put something on the planes? If we're really involved on a war on terrorism, why haven't we gone after Saudi Arabia that's funding this whole world terrorist movement? If we're really involved in the war on terrorism, then why is it that targeting law-abiding citizens with all this legislation, and why is the Patriot Act being used far more for other crimes like drug pushers and other things, labeling them as terrorists and putting them in prison rather than the terrorists?
Well, it's called control, and as I understand, when you travel, if you're coded yellow or orange, they won't tell you. The only time you'll know is when you're coded red, and you will not be able to travel. An interesting scene in the movie America where Peter, the county administrator, and Gary, who worked at the local bank, they were in front of the fireplace, and they were burning paper money. they were burning the green money that we have now. And the county administrator says, looks like monopoly money to me. And the bank person, Gary, says, well, the exiles are being forced to turn in their dollars so they can get relief, food, and clothing. And I thought that was a very interesting scene regarding our money that's now not backed by anything, really.
And, of course, why is it that we're coming up with a new colored $20 bill? Because, of course, this whole scenario has to do with money. The first 80 pages of the Patriot Act, nobody's ever told you, it all deals with finance and with our international financial institutions. The first 80 pages of the 140-page Patriot Act, USA Patriot Act, deals with finances. What's wrong with this scenario?
Right.
It really has to do, of course, with control. Well, we've got somebody's on the line. We've got Tony calling in. Hi, Tony. How you doing?
How you doing, Dr. Stan?
Oh, I'm doing just fine. Thank you.
I like your guest.
Hi, Tony.
Hi. Oh, you're talking about paper money and about them burning it up. And I was looking at David Morgan's website yesterday.
Now, that's the gentleman we've had on talking about silver.
Right. And there's a couple of links I went to. And there was a report that came out yesterday from the International Monetary Fund.
Right.
I don't know if you've heard this.
No, I haven't.
Well, they warned, this is yesterday, they warned that the U.S. dollar, and I'm going to quote them, could collapse at any moment.
At any moment. Well, of course, this really, we're doing everything wrong. We're running up massive deficits. We're running up massive trade deficits. We will have the largest single federal deficit in all recorded history next year. And, of course, all of this is going, so much of it is going into war effort. We've already spent $79 billion on Iraq. We plan to put another $87 billion. Of course, a lot of this is going to Dick Cheney's old corporation, Halliburton, and Charles Schultz's Bechtel. And, of course, this is how the great corporations are siphoning off the tax money. And in fact, all of this has to do with taking money from poor people in rich countries and giving it to rich corporations in rich companies, countries. That's what it's really all about. We're not fighting terrorism over in Iraq. In fact, there was no relationship between Iraq and Al-Qaeda. There were no weapons of mass destruction, and they simply lied to us from the beginning. But, of course, the one thing that will topple this country faster than anything is a monetary collapse. And do you have that article? Could you make a copy of that and send it to me?
Oh, sure. Yeah. Did you get that fax I sent you?
No, I haven't been on my email for a couple of days.
No, fax? You'd ask me?
Oh, yes, I did get that fax.
Okay. Another interesting thing that I came across in the last 2 days was on the U.S. government website, because I had heard Ron Paul talking about the new colored money that's coming out. And on the U.S. government website yesterday, I saw that the new colored money is coming out next month, and it's going to be peach colored.
No, of course. Does Ron Paul tell us why they're doing this? Are we going to have a dual money, one internationally and one locally? Are we going to have, of course, basically some sort of exchange controls? What's this all about?
Well, I printed out a speech that he just gave. This was just like about last week. Let me see if I have it here. I know I have it somewhere. I don't know if it's right in front of me or not. But it was basically referring to the tyranny that's going on right now in the monetary system. I read the whole thing. I gave it to my son. I'm trying to. Don't have it here. But
is that on his website?
I have it, Dr.
All right, fine.
You know what I'm talking about, Jeannie?
Yeah, I read the whole article.
Yeah, and I forget exactly what he was putting his finger on as to why, but I seem to remember that there was something to the effect that either the current green money or monopoly money, Federal Reserve notes we have, or they're going to come out with the colored one, and then either the colored one or the one in the international, like other countries that it's used as a, they use as a reserve, one of them will be highly devalued.
All right, fine. As I suspect, of course, what they're eventually going to do is simply say that the dollars which are overseas will no longer be valued, and they'll just wipe out the savings of people in Russia and South America and impoverish even more people.
Yeah. Well, anyway, I thought I was wondering, like, why when the IMF comes out with that report and says that the dollar could collapse at any moment. I mean, this is not some right-wing so-called, you know, as a Chronicle would call some right-wing extremist group or something, you know, the IMF.
Well, of course, but Tony, don't you worry. They've got everything in place. They're putting in those detention camps. We have the ability to establish a military police state at any time, and, of course, for the Office of Homeland Security to, of course, establish a fascist dictatorship. But, of course, in the name of fighting terrorism, terrorism would be people who are concerned about the collapse of their money and the loss of their savings.
Well, I said it. I thought it was interesting that it's not on the front page of the local papers, what the IMF said.
Well, that's why we want people listening to Radio Liberty. And where can people get that now?
It was off a link of David Morgan's. He's with the...
And what's that website?
What is it, the Silver Institute? Or?
Well, why don't you get that? Just send me a fax.
I'll fax it. I'll print it out tomorrow and I'll fax it to you.
Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay, fine, Jeannie.
Yeah,
do you have anything on that article?
Yeah, Liberty Committee, that's Ron Paul.
Right.
And just do a Google on that, and it's on that website.
All right, fine.
Yeah. I want to mention before we close, in the movie America, they had administrative areas. Administrative areas might include four or five states grouped together. And, of course, we went into regional areas in 1969-1970 by Nixon in the Congress. And there was to be a new post in the government, and this was to be called Governor General. And this was the man that was supposed to be like a governor of the state, but he would be governor general of the regional area. In this area, in the movie, it was the Heartland area. And they were going to divide up the United States of America into different countries. And to me, that made sense because the United States is so powerful and so big, and the people are of a common philosophy. They do have to break up the United States of America into different countries. They now, with internet, we can go all over the world, but they do have the ability to cut off communication between different areas. And this is what I believe will happen, is people in one area will not know what's happening in another area. And so there again, you're kind of isolated and secluded, and you don't know what's happening in the other part of the United States.
Well, we saw that at the time of the Oklahoma City bombing when, of course, down in Oklahoma, everybody knew that, of course, there were multiple bombs in the building that had all been defused, and yet that information was suppressed all across the rest of the country. Anybody who could not see in those videos that cover up in Oklahoma City, we actually have the film footage shot in Oklahoma on the day of the, of course, of the bombing and suppressed all across America. The same thing would be true of the testimony of Eleanor Hill, who was, of course, the director of the task force that associated with the select committee on the investigation of 9/11. Her testimony pointing out that everything we had heard, you know, like the terrorists were here, of course they kept to themselves, really wasn't true. The fact that the government had no idea that there was going to be an attack on the World Trade Center, of course they did, and all of her testimony was there. We knew the attack was coming, we knew it was going to be in America, we knew it was going to involve planes, and we knew the World Trade Center was a possible target, and her testimony totally censored by the committee, by the media. We have that available through Radio Liberty. That's the testimony of Eleanor Hill, or get it down off the website. Go ahead, Jeannie.
In the movie America with a K, there was a scene regarding the teenagers being at a Hard Rock concert. and they would show the videotape of the 1968 Democratic Convention, and the jock there was actually agitating the children, and they started yelling hooligans, trash it, because of what happened at the 1968 Democratic Convention. And these kids ran out of the building, and they set fire to the police car, and they also smashed the windows. And standing above in an apartment was the county administrator and the Russian colonel. And the county administrator, Robert Urich, said, "What's happening?" And the Russian colonel said, "It's your young people attacking the symbols of power they can not see. There are ways to make them feel good. It doesn't accomplish anything." And here's the hook. The Russian colonel said, "Actually, it's a control provocation," meaning that they stir them up, they get the kids to release their frustrations, we keep track of them, and we give them a scare, rest some, but it's a way for the teenagers to release their frustrations.
And it's sort of like the anti-war demonstrations. They were all staged. They controlled both the pro-war and the anti-war movement. The same thing with communism, the pro-communist, the anti-communist, the pro-socialist, the conservative, the Republicans, the Democrats control both sides. There is no opposition.
One of the scenes in America with a K, there were people standing in line for vegetables, for tomatoes. And there was a sign in back saying, "Relocation Compound." And the woman in charge of this handing out and overseeing things, she said to Amanda, which was the county administrator's wife, "Welcome to America's Russian-inspired real-life animal park." And that, to me, was devastating because it was such a scene of, you could have been in Russia because everyone was waiting in line for just a few potatoes, a few tomatoes.
In fact, I think of that every time I'm going through these security checks at the airport. And of course, they're not. This is all perception. This is to give us the idea we're really involved in a war on terrorism. You got to take off your shoes because of John Reed, the mad shoe bomber. Of course. His shoes never could have exploded because they were C4, and he was trying to light a fuse, and you have to have blasting caps. But you see, they created that impression in the minds of the American people. My goodness, somebody might be having a bomb in their shoes. And of course, poor old John Reed's going to spend the rest of his life in prison because nobody ever told him you couldn't explode C4 with a fuse. Well, we're out of time, Jeannie. Do you have a parting thought for our listeners tonight?
Well, it's so important to understand who is behind this. It's not just Russia, the communists, the Marxists. Who are the powerful elite that's around the corner, like in The Wizard of Oz, the man behind the curtain?
Amen to that. God bless you, Jeannie. Thanks so much for being with us. And this is the time when I have to remind you, Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and quite frankly, we need your help. We need to expand. We need to get this program on the shortwave. And if we have enough people out there who will contribute and help us, why, we will get this on the shortwave. And people all across America can hear the truth that they're not getting from the controlled media. Pray for America. Pray for our Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. And so until tomorrow evening at the same time, Dr. Stan, good night. And may the Lord be with you.